This is Fresh Air, and I'm Terry Gross. My guest is Artie Shaw, one of jazz's greatest big band leaders and clarinetists. In the 1930s and 40s, his band ranked with the Goodman, Dorsey, and Miller bands in popularity. The Shaw Band made one of its most popular records at its first recording session in 1938. It was a song by Cole Porter called Begin the Begin. Artie Shaw began his career playing with dance bands. He grew contemptuous of the band's crowd-pleasing antics and their trite music. When he organized his own big band in 1938, he rejected many of the pop tunes that had become dance band staples and instead created his repertoire from originals and songs by composers like Porter, Gershwin, and Berlin. His huge popular success brought unexpected torments. He temporarily left music in 1939, frustrated with a performing career that depended on what he figured as 90% business and 10% art. Well, that was neither the first nor the last time he left music. He made one of his returns to music in 1953 to lead his small group, the Gramercy Five, which featured the unusual combination of clarinet, harpsichord, electric guitar, bass, and drums. Shaw disbanded the group after a year, began a 30-year retirement from music, and permanently gave up playing clarinet. After writing two books and becoming a film producer, Shaw returned to music in 1980 to organize a new big band. He chose Dick Johnson to play the solo clarinet parts and front the band. The new band plays some of the Shaw Band's most popular arrangements, including Frenesy, Back Bay Shuffle, Stardust, and of course Begin the Begin. Nevertheless, Artie Shaw winced when he heard me play the record of Begin the Begin.
Well, because I've played that thing probably, I don't know how many thousands of times by now, and it's got to the point where it's fine to have a hit record, it pays rent, but it can drive you crazy, like an actor playing the same part. You know, a lot of actors don't mind that, but it can drive you nuts. I mean, Bogart became a caricature of Bogart after a while, and I get tired of that. I don't like being stereotyped. So I made maybe 500 records. Why Begin the Begin? All right, it's a good piece, a good arrangement. But, my God, I don't want to be characterized as only Begin the Begin. That's what people seem to think is all I ever did.
It became the song that you were probably most associated with. How did you choose it? How did you choose to record it? It wasn't a popular song.
No, it was a flop. It was one of Cole Porter's few flop tunes and from one of his very few flop shows, Jubilee. I happened to get to the theater on Friday. The show closed Saturday. And I just heard that tune, and it was done in a kind of Latin beat. And I liked the melody. It was a hell of a good song. It still is. And a very big departure from most popular songs of those days, which were 8-8, Bridge and 8, or 8-8 and then 8-8. I mean, 1-2, 1-2. So I heard the tune, and I came back. I was looking for an identity for the band. I told you we were looking for good songs from sophisticated songwriters. So I said to Jerry Gray, let's do Begin the Begin. He didn't know what the tune was. We got a copy, and we sat down and worked out the arrangement that everybody now knows. And I had no idea it was the other side of a record that we thought was going to be the big one. It's always been true. Frenesy was the other side of a record we thought was going to be a big one. Nobody knows what's going to be the hit. I'll tell you an interesting story about Stardust, the record that I have. Harry Meyerson was then A&R man, whatever that is. They didn't have A&R man, but he was a production manager for RCA Records in California. It was then Victor. He came to me one day and said, the company wants to try a stunt if you'd be willing to participate in. We'd like to do a two-sided version. They had 78s in those days, A and B side. We're going to do a side with no A, we're a record with no A or B. You and Tommy Dorsey are our two biggest sellers, and we want to put each of you on one side of the two-sided record. It'd be Stardust, big song. We'd like to have each of you do your own version of it. Do whichever you want, you know, 3 1/4-minute version. So I did that. I had this string section with the band, went in, made the record. I did a sketch. Lenny Hayton did the orchestration. And we put it together and went in, did one version, and left, take one. And I said, it's not going to get any better, so we left. About 3 weeks later, I talked to Harry. I said, I heard Tommy was in. I hadn't spoken to him, but I heard he was in. Did he make his side? He said, no, he didn't. He said, you're going to have to come in and make 3 more sides so we can have a 4-record release. I said, why? He said, Tommy came in the studio with his men, and he said, let me hear what Artie did. So I played him the record. He heard it on those big speakers, and he said, I'm not going to get on the other side of that. he would have sold 16 million records if he got on this other side. But Tommy and I never had any invidiousness. We were very good friends. And he respected that record.
Did you like his band?
Tommy? Oh, he was a good good musician. Tommy never made a bad record in his life. I thought he made some cheap shot things, but at his best, and I think everybody's got a right to be judged by his best, at his best, he was a phenomenal guy.
From your perspective, who were the best band leaders of that time?
Well, I don't know. You can't rate them in any order, but I would say the prominent ones were Dorsey, Goodman, myself, Basie, Ellington. Before that, there was Lunsford. Chick Webb was there. Fletcher wrote some nice arrangements, but his band never was all that good. He had some good players. He had Coleman, he had Tricky Sam, he had Louis Armstrong for a while. He had great players in his band. But as a band leader, he didn't have the kind of rigid, iron-like discipline you need to run a band. But there were the bands. Glenn Miller, I didn't consider, but oddly enough, he's the apotheosis of what jazz bands are supposed to be about today, big band.
And why do you think that is?
Oh, he was sort of Lawrence Welk of his day. Mechanical, wind it up and it swingas. The thing about his band and Jimmy Dorsey's band, bands of that ilk, I went to hear Jimmy once at the Blue. Somebody took me to hear his band. They said, "You got a good band." I went in and listened to it. And I didn't seem to be enthusiastic to the guy who was with me. And he said, "Didn't you like it?" I said, "Well, they don't make any mistakes. If you don't make mistakes, you're not trying. It's no surprises. Everything is written out and worked out. And if a guy plays a solo, set it that way. Do the same thing. We do that very seldom." But the Miller bands and the Jimmy Dorsey bands and a few of those, and I'm not speaking ill of them, they were very good craftsmen. They knew what they were doing, but it got to me a little boring. I can't listen to it very much.
You retired in 1954, and it's only now that you've gotten back into any performance again. What were your reasons in 54 for, you know, pretty permanently giving up music?
I really quit the big band business in 1949. That was the last time I stood in front of a big band. I had a great band in 49, one of the finest bands I've ever led. The musicians, man for man, and their performances in the book, the arrangements, everything. I had the best arrangers in the world writing for me. And everybody liked it but the people, as the gag goes. The audience couldn't understand what we were doing. We were out of their comprehension entirely. And, of course, I knew that. But I hoped that since I was going to have to stand in front of a band anyway, I might as well have one that wouldn't bore me to tears. Well, it so happened that my musical sensibilities had by that time evolved to a point where, in order to please myself, I had to, without realizing it, not only displease but antagonize most of my audiences who wanted me to keep going back and playing standard brands. But so in 49, I broke that band up. I never was going to come back again. Then in 54, I got into some financial trouble, and I needed some money. So I put together a Gramercy 5, figuring at least I could play to smaller audiences who would maybe not be more discriminating, but they would certainly allow more to happen, jazz clubs. So we went out with that group you mentioned, Hank Jones, Tal Farlow, etc. And I did that, but I found that the more I did it, the more and more people thought this was music to converse by. You get into a nightclub and people come in, they get fractured out of their skulls and they start shouting over the music. So then we have to play louder to get over them and then they got to get louder to be heard. And it's an endless competition. So I got tired of it. You're not in business to go out and play. You're in business to play music, not to fight.
In your autobiography, you wrote that music offered for you a way out of a kind of life that you hated and that you were running away from normal life. What's the kind of normal life that you were envisioning that you didn't want for yourself, that you chose music as an alternative to?
Well, I don't want to be part of the homogenization of America. The man wrote the book about the greening of America. I think America is being in the process of homogenized. Everything is becoming a bland, non-entity, flat, sort of concretized surface. What's underneath that? The dark side of America is very rarely talked about in the public media. I was living in a very dark life. I didn't like the life I lived. My parents put me in a position I didn't like being in. They were constantly squabbling until my father left when I was 13. And I was, in effect, relieved to see him go. It put an end to the squabbling and bitter, violent fighting that took place. And all I knew is I grew up very, very miserably. And by the time I was about 14 or 15, I'd evolved a need to get out of there. So as a kid, at 14, I heard a guy play an instrument, saxophone as it happened. Well, at the age of 15, I had one. I was making a living at it. And at the age of 16, I was gone forever from home.
The early bands that you played with were bands that you called entertaining bands.
That's all there was. There were no jazz bands then that you could make a living in. I mean, if you were lucky enough to be black, you could play jazz, because that's the only music they had in the ghettos. But I was playing in the white world. And in the white world, there was no room to play jazz and make a living. So I ended up at the best jobs there were, studio work. And there it got to be utterly incredible. You were playing things like Manhattan Merry-Go-Round, the Lucky Strike Hit Parade. Well, that's scary. You're playing as a two for two what they like. What was it, true what they say about Dixie for 13 weeks in a row? That can be enough to drive any halfway decent musician clear out of his head.
You had said that when you were playing for the entertaining bands that you started to really hate the whole concept of showmanship.
I still do.
What were the kinds of showmanship antics that people in the band were called on to perform?
Glenn Miller's band waving the trombones around from side to side as they play, saxophones holding their instruments up in the air and doing everything but playing serious music. The guys in my band one night, I came back to the band. I'd left them for about 3 weeks. They were out on the road. And they were playing a tune that I wrote for the band called, an arrangement I made called Lady Be Good. At the end of the last chorus, the band does something, the saxophones do a fast kind of whinny trill, and the guys for kicks were holding their horns up, and the trombones were doing that, and I looked at them, I was appalled. I said, what are you guys doing? They said, oh, it's for fun. I said, the audience doesn't know it's fun. They think you're doing showmanship, and if we have to do showmanship, that means we're very insecure about the music. Sit down and respect what you do. If you don't, they won't. And they heard that.
When you finally assembled a big band of your own, and I'm referring now to the second big band after the one with the string quartet in it, what did you do with that band to differentiate yourself from the kinds of pop bands that you were bored and disenchanted with?
Yeah, that's a reasonable question. It's got a reasonable answer. All right, we had a big band. Most of the then big bands that were playing what they thought was jazz were playing pretty much Ida, Avalon, whatever those songs, That's a Plenty, King Porter Stomp, blah, 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 blah. All the so-called jazz literature. I decided that there were some great compositions being written by American popular composers like Kern, Gershwin, Porter, Rogers, name it. These were the great composers in America, and they had written at a level of sophistication for the musical comedy, which wasn't, quote, dance music, but it was repertoire, music that had to do with advancing the cause of a book or a story. So I found songs like Begin, songs like, Yesterdays of Kern's, What Is This Thing Called Love, all of that repertory. I decided to play the best music written by the best American composers, and instead of imposing a, quote, style, end quote, on it, play the piece in the manner that would best enhance that particular piece in a way that the composer might not have realized he had written. I tell my audiences now, we play Softly's in the Morning Sunrise. That was a piece written for an operetta called New Moon, Sigmund Romberg. I knew Rami. He was a nice guy, and he was a big, lusty Viennese guy who wrote American music. He came over here when he was a young man. He learned to write the American popular idiom, but he was writing operetta. And we wrote the piece. We played it in a quite different manner. And when Rami heard it, he called me up. He said, Arti, I think I like it almost better than the way I wrote it, which I considered a high compliment from him because he was a scrupulous craftsman.
It was customary for the big bands to have vocalists, usually what was called a girl vocalist and a boy vocalist.
Girl singer,
a girl singer, them. Yeah. Now, I got the impression that you resented the demand for singers and would have preferred if you had the opportunity to just lead an instrumental
band. I'm doing
band.
It now. We have no singer. Last year, we went out with a singer. Again, I felt I had to make that public concession. People want to hear those fatuous, vapid words. It makes them feel comfortable when they hear, I love you, and we're all going to grow up and have a great life together. They love those words. They're stupid words, mostly. They have nothing to do with reality. Certainly not to do with today's reality. That's why the kids are buying all these rock singers. They're talking about Vietnam and something blowing in the wind and all that. Or even a material girl, which has very little to do with, happy little lyrics.
One sign of success, I think, when you were performing is if people were dancing. What did you think of dancing? You have that famous comment that all jitterbuggers are morons.
I didn't say all.
Okay. did you not like it when people danced?
I don't care what they do. It has no meaning to me. What I care about is they come there and buy a ticket and support the band. That's really all that matters. And if they like it, that's great. If they don't like it, I'm still doing what I got to do. Dancing is totally irrelevant. If you want to dance, a windshield wiper will do it. All you need is a beat. You don't need what we do,
in the 30s and early 40s, a common question that people would ask was, well, who do you think is really the king? Is it Artie or Benny? Were you aware of that whole public competition?
How could
between
I not
you
be?
Goodman?
I was part of that controversy. That it makes no bloody sense. We weren't doing the same things. The fact is we played a clarinet. We each played a clarinet. But the music was different. As a matter of fact, I'll tell you an interesting little anecdote. I had occasion to talk to Benny about something once that I wanted to do, and I needed him, and I needed the Dorsey people, and I needed the Stan Kenton and Guy Lombardo and all of the big band leaders. And I got okay from everybody. Goodman didn't want to do it. And he kept asking me questions about clarinet players. What do you think about so-and-so? What do you think about this guy, that guy? I said, this guy's too schmaltzy, that guy's too rigid, knowing what he expected me to say, and I was zinging him a little bit. So I said, finally, Benny, you're too hung up on the clarinet. And he looked at me and says, that's what we do, isn't it? I said, no, I'm trying to play music. I'm not interested in clarinet. It's a means. It's an instrument. You use an instrument to do something with. And I saw a tiny light bulb go on in his eyes. I don't think he ever seriously considered the idea that the clarinet was a means, not an end.
My guest is Artie Shaw. When you were leading a jazz band, the bands were still pretty segregated. There were black bands and white bands.
In New York City, there was a local union, 802, white. Then there was a Harlem union for blacks. There was no way if you could mix. The only thing you could do on records now and then, you'd play with a black guy. I'd get on a record. There would be Coleman Hawkins there or Lester or whoever, Cozy Cole playing drums. Rarely was there a white. Well, there were no black playing with white musicians. Matter of fact, when I hired Billie Holiday, boy, was that not a scandal. It was amazing. I must have been very naive, or else I had my head buried in what I was doing. I had tunnel vision. When I hired her because she was sincerely, for me, a sincere attempt to get the best singer I could get. But she joined the band, and it was a very, very strange experience. I'll tell you another story you won't believe. This is in a documentary film that some woman did about me, a woman named Bridget Berman. It's a film called Artie Shaw, Time Is All You've Got, which is a quote from one of our interviews. At the time I hired Lips Page, Hot Lips Page, for the band, that was 1941 or something like that, just before World War II, before Pearl Harbor. We were supposed to do a very lucrative tour of the South. My agent gave me the figures and the times and so on. It sounded okay, so I signed contracts. He came back a couple of weeks later, very, very pale. He said, I don't know what we're going to do about this. Already we're in real trouble. I don't think they're going to accept what you're doing. I said, what are you talking about? He said, well, they want to cancel the tour. I said, why? He said, well, you got Lips Page in there. They want you to put a white guy in there. I said, forget it. Then they could tell me what kind of a band I'll have. This is my band. They want to hire us. They take what I got. So he went away he's chagrined because there was a lot of money in it. Came back about 3 or 4 days later, said, I think I got it solved. I talked to some of them. One guy came up with a suggestion that could solve it. I said, what's that? He said, you can play the tour, use Lips Page, but he can't sit nearer than 15 feet from the nearest man in the band. I said, you mean I'm going to have 3 trumpet players over in one place with the band, and he's going to sit in a little chair all by himself way over there 20 feet away? Yeah, I said, forget the whole tour. We canceled the tour. You believe that? That's only, 40 years ago. Few years ago. We've made some strides.
Well, when you hired Billie Holiday, she was, I believe, the first black singer to perform with a white
band.
Well,
to work in a white band, steadily, sure, as a member of the band. She didn't come out as a specialty act. See, I mean, when Benny Goodman had, say, Lionel and Teddy Wilson, they came out as a separate thing. They weren't in the band. When I had Lips Page, he sat in the band. Roy Eldridge was in the band. I had Zooty Singleton in my band in 1937. Well, that was unheard of. We played the Million Dollar Pier. People said, isn't he a black man? I said, well, he's hardly that tan. But it was very, very nip and tuck. People used very, very angry at it.
Were there places you couldn't play with Billie Holiday?
No. We went to the South. That was difficult because Billie had a short fuse and people would say things about it and she would blow. So I always had a guy ready to spirit her away, put her in a bus and get her out because she would blow. She'd call a guy every kind of MF you could think of. And they didn't take that too well. See, they would refer to as, they would say, have the nigger wench sing another song. I couldn't believe my ears. I'd say, you mean Billy singing another song? No, the nigger wench. That's what they thought of her as.
Was there any pressure on you by the men in the band to not have any black performers in it? Did anyone ever say, look, you know, you're going to lose us gigs?
Hell no.
We can't afford
the men loved her, and they loved Lips, and they loved Roy. I mean, these were sterling performers. I would have liked to have four of them, but about one was all I could handle. The people would not accept much more.
You enlisted during World War II and ended up playing with your band on
the
Pacific Front. Yeah. Did you know when you enlisted that you'd be mostly performing? Was that the arrangement that was made?
No, I had no idea what I was going to be doing. I was on the stage in Providence, Rhode Island, when I went back in the wings while the dance act went on. We were doing an hour show, as they called it. And the stagehand's radio was on, and we were hearing a hysterical announcer talking about the Japs having bombed Pearl Harbor. Well, Pearl Harbor sounded like some sleepy little atoll out there in the South Pacific. I didn't know that Pearl Harbor was our principal naval base in the Pacific. But he sounded hysterical, and World War II had begun. I had to go back out on stage. Just before I went out, I got a note from the manager, please announce that all military personnel is to report to its bases immediately. This was right near Newport, where there was a sub base, a naval base, an Air Force base, all that. So I went out on stage and did that, and about three quarters of the house got empty. I hadn't realized, you know, you take it for granted, men were more and more people showing up in uniforms. World War II was out there, but it seemed somehow distant. And when the Japs attacked Pearl Harbor, I suddenly had to see myself. I got a kind of Satori view of myself going out there and saying, now, ladies and gentlemen, our next tune will be. It sounded so irrelevant to this conflagration that World War II represented to me that I thought, I can't do this. I did it, announced the tune. I think it was Stardust. And as the band started playing, I turned to Les Robinson, who was in the first row, saxophone players. He was the lead. And I said, Les, pass the word, 2 weeks' notice. Total impulse. And 3 weeks later, I was down on Church Street enlisting in the Navy. I just felt that there was no place for me as a civilian. This was the big experience of my life, had to be part of it. I don't know, or I didn't at that time, know that much about why Hitler was there, but I knew we had something to do with it. And I figured no matter how he got there, we had to stop him, or the world would come to an end, as we knew it. As it did come to an end. But I didn't know it was going to come to, wouldn't have come to quite the same end if he'd been there. Because if he'd had the atom bomb, there's no question we would have ceased to exist, maybe. In any case, I joined the Navy, and I went in as an apprentice seaman, as low as you could get. I could have become a commander if I'd wanted to. I didn't know that. I knew Forrestal, who was then undersecretary. And when I joined up, I had seen him, and he said, if you get in trouble, come see me. Well, after about 6 or 8 weeks of minesweeper duty, or Staten Island, this, that, and the other, I found myself doing what an apprentice seaman does. I thought the Navy would have enough rationality to put me into the job I could do best for them and then give me whatever rate or rank I needed for that. I was very naive, you know. I didn't realize that the military service doesn't operate rationally. They looked at one stripe or no stripe, and they gave me a swab de deck sailor. Well, that's kind of stupid. I was building shelves under a stairway to put mops and buckets on. So I went to see Forrestal. I went AWOL, went down there and saw him in his office. And he laughed, and he said, all right, I'll put you in touch with somebody. And I got in touch with the head of enlisted men, a man named Admiral Bledsoe. And he gave me carte blanche to get a band together. He said, what do you want to do? I said, what do you want me to do? He said, get a band together. It's the best you can do for us. Where? I said, where's the Navy? He said, in the Pacific. I said, okay. So he gave me total carte blanche. I enlisted a bunch of guys who were 1A, and got the best band that ever was. That band was a tremendous band. We won the Esquire Poll and all that. We traveled all over the Pacific in places where the Bob Hopes couldn't go. We went to forward areas. We were on battleships. We were on aircraft carriers. We were all over the place.
After the war, the big bands pretty well dispersed.
Yeah, I think that the interest in big bands began to die. It's a sort of two-pronged thing. On the one hand, you had bands like Tommy Dorsey, and I like Tommy. We were very good friends, and we worked together. But Tommy got a little cynical, and he had the Pied Pipers and Frank Sinatra, and they became more lazy music. You'd lean back, not have to worry so much. A background music for an arranger is very easy to write. And you have the singers doing it, so they're doing it. And that's all. Glenn Miller, on the other hand, came along with the Modern Airs in Chattanooga, Choo Choo and Pardon Me Boy. How do you like that one for a title, Pardon Me Boy? Tell that to a black man today, he's liable to break your head. But anyway, that was the way it was. Jukebox, Saturday Night, all this kind of lowest common denominator entertainment music. So that paved the way for what they call the singers' parade that's come along. The other hand, you had the Stan Kentons going way out of the audience's comprehension, to the point where the audience is saying, what are we supposed to listen to? And there was Lawrence Welk at the other end waiting for them. There's the melody. Hey, Roger, shall we play? And then he did it. So that was it. I was astounded when I came back from Spain. I went to Spain in 1950, stayed there till 55. And I came back and somebody said, it's changed, it's better now. Well, they meant that Ornette Coleman was playing at the five spot. But that doesn't mean better. That just means you got a tiny little audience of artists listening to something that's a little innovative. But meanwhile, on the television, I happened to turn on the tube and there was Lawrence Welk. I knew him as a territory guy playing accordion, which I don't even consider an instrument. And then you had, on the other hand, you had Mitch Miller milking a cow and conducting the Yellow Rose of Texas. And then one night I saw an astounding sight, a guy playing the piano with candles on the candle and his nose wrinkling, and he's playing Chopin with such skill that you wondered why it was played so badly. And that turned out to be a fellow named Liberace. And I thought, my God, this is what jazz or music, American music, has come to. And my friends would say, it's getting better. I'd say, look at your mass media. The Liberace, Mitch Miller, and Lawrence Welk. Those are the musical programs on the air. Don't tell me that's better. We're back to Irving Aronson and his Commanders, which I quit and discussed when I was 29, when I was 19, rather.
So you had to figure out if there was a place for you in music. And
there wasn't. That's why I didn't stay with music, and that's why I lived in Lakeville, Connecticut, and I wrote a book. That's what I did.
There's a real nostalgia craze now for the big bands. Do you want to be part of that? What do you think of nostalgia?
I don't even like the word in its present context. Nostalgia is a good poetic word, a yearning for something of the past that moves you. But now it's become a word people huckster. They put it on corners and sell nostalgia. It's become a commodity. That's not what it's about. I don't care if people come to hear my band for that reason. They can come for any reason they want. But I'm going to play. I'm not going to minister to it.
How do you like fronting your band now? How do you like leading your band now?
If I didn't like it, I wouldn't be there. I don't do anything I don't like anymore. I try very hard to avoid that. There's only one thing to do. That's what you're best at. You're best at what you love to do. This band pumps me up. People ask me how I stay so vital, etc., at my age. I say, get in front of the band some night, and you'll see what I mean. You are getting back something that you did 50 years ago, 40 years ago, and it's coming back to you in a brand new way with the feeling that it's going to be around another 100 years. That's an inspiriting feeling, very heartening. You realize you've created a durable piece of Americana, and it's going to be around long after you are.
That was Artie Shaw, my guest on this edition of Fresh Air. Artie Shaw gave up playing the clarinet in the mid-1950s, but he recently organized a new big band. Fresh Air is a production of WHYY Radio in Philadelphia. The engineer for this edition was Joyce Lieberman. Fresh Air is edited by Maeve McGoran. Amy Salad is the associate producer. Danny Miller and I co-produce the show. My name's Terry Gross, and I want to thank you for listening.
National distribution of Fresh Air is made possible with the financial support of listeners to WHYY-FM, Philadelphia. Additional funding comes from National Public Radio member stations and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is NPR, National Public Radio.